You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is David Rovics and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Woorong and Boomerang language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand, respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia where our broadcast reaches. We acknowledge that there will be no climate justice without First Nations justice. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show on 3CR 855 AM. My name is Shay and I'm your host for today. On today's episode, I will be chatting to Gavin, the Climate and Energy Program Manager at the Australian Conservation Foundation. They will be giving an update on current campaigns and what's been going on with ACF this past month. This is a new series we will be doing, so we're hoping to get Gavin on monthly to chat with us about climate and energy news, and we'll hear from them shortly. And then later on, I'll be chatting to Mary from Climate for Change. Mary was on the show last week to promote some events that Climate for Change had going on across Melbourne and Sydney, and they're back again this week to talk about climate communication and to share some tips for having effective conversations about climate change. So stay tuned for what's to come. I'm joined on the line with Gavin, the Climate and Energy Program Manager at the Australian Conservation Foundation. Gavin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And you're going to be giving us a roundup of what's been going on lately with ACF's campaigns. Take it away.
Yeah, well, in particular, I just want to let you and your listeners know that the Australian Conservation Foundation and Greenpeace are about to really crank up our campaign to stop Woodside's offshore gas Browse project from going ahead. So people in WA would know a lot more about this, but on the East Coast, maybe not so much. So this will be the biggest fossil fuel approval or rejection decision that the Albanese government will make in this parliamentary term, in this three-year term. It's an enormous project. It's an offshore gas project. It's about 300 kilometres offshore from the Northwest Shelf. It's going to take about a 900-kilometre pipeline to get that gas to Karratha, to the controversial Northwest Shelf gas port. And the federal government will be making a decision whether this project should go ahead or be rejected at the end of this year or perhaps early next year. The reason why this is so important to us is that this isn't your average, like, coal mine extension, maybe in regional Queensland that people might have heard of or in New South Wales. This project is absolutely next level. It's 1.6 billion tonnes of carbon emissions. It's really absolutely off the charts. That's four times Australia's annual emissions. It's about 1 year of the Safeguard Mechanism, our major emissions reduction program for industrial emissions. And the emissions are so high that the Australian National University can calculate the impact of those emissions on coral death on the Great Barrier Reef on the other side of the country. And that's just the climate impacts. It's also involving this project. We'll drill 50 wells around Scott Reef, one of the largest intact reef ecosystems left in the world. That ecosystem has 25 threatened species listed under our national environmental laws and about 44 migratory species. We're also concerned that this project will lead to subsistence in that reef. That reef will collapse and destroy that reef forever. So when it comes to the natural values impacts of this project and the climate impacts, this is the most egregious project, as I said, that will come for the Albanese government for approval or rejection in this parliamentary term. And Greenpeace and ACF are determined to encourage the Australian public to get involved in this campaign and say that they don't want this climate wrecking project to go ahead.
And what is, you said the government is, they haven't yet approved it. What are some of the decisions or the factors that will go into their decision?
Yeah, so the Environment Minister is Minister Murray Watt, and this is a approval or rejection under Australia's nature laws, the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. And as I said, it will make a determination on whether the impacts of that project are acceptable or not. When the minister makes that decision, it's primarily on natural values grounds that he will be able to consider whether this project should be rejected. So on those nature impacts, I said, especially the impacts on endangered species. I mentioned there were 25 of them. Some of the iconic species that we're talking about here are the pygmy blue whale. There's a subspecies of green turtle that's found just on the west coast, not on Australia's east coast, as well as a whole range of other threatened species. So it'll be on the impact on natural values and the critters there at Scott Reef, for which the minister will make a decision.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the likelihood of, or the outcome of that decision is likely to be?
Well, I think Australians, under the leadership of ACF and Greenpeace, are going to have to really step up this campaign on the east coast. So people who are concerned about climate change and the protection of Australia's incredible natural and cultural values will be seeing emails and messages and digital media on their feeds and outdoor advertising and so forth, encouraging people to get involved in that campaign. Right now, you can go to the Australian Conservation Foundation's website, and that will give you the opportunity just this week to write a submission that we'll guide you through to tell Minister Watt that you don't want this project to go ahead and why. So check out the Australian Conservation Foundation's website. If you want to sign a petition, go to Greenpeace's website. But if you stay in touch with those websites and sign up to our mailing list, we'll be sending people over the next 6 months various opportunities to get involved to make sure this climate wrecking, nature wrecking project does not proceed.
And have Woodside, have they sort of released any kind of or changed their proposals after the environmental impact assessment report was done, or have they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So after the Western Australian Environmental Protection Agency back in 2024 recommended rejection of this project, it was so egregious they recommended it shouldn't go ahead. We obtained that, we didn't, but that information was obtained under Freedom of Information. So we know that the WA Environment Protection Agency already recommended rejection. On the basis of that, Woodside did tweak their proposal slightly, but we think it goes nowhere near ameliorating neither the natural values or the climate impacts of this project. For example, Woodside, in their submissions to government, have already admitted that oil spills from this project would be absolutely catastrophic to Scott Reef. And we don't think that's just one example of the dangers in this project and how Woodside is unable to deal with the impacts of this project. It's just the emissions are so high and the natural values impacts so close to an iconic reef ecosystem are so risky that this project just can't proceed. So we don't think there's anything really that Woodside can do to make this project acceptable. It's just so egregious, both from a natural values impact perspective and also because the climate emissions are just so, so high.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the knock-on effects if it did go through? I mean, you mentioned Scott Reef and its sort of environmental significance, but is there sort of other impacts that aren't immediately obvious?
Well, we also think there's economic impact. So obviously one of the arguments that a lot of your listeners would be familiar with is that, oh, don't we need more gas here for Australia? Don't we need more gas to support renewable energy as we transition? This gas will all be for export. None or very little of this gas will ever be available to the Australian domestic market. It would also be the most expensive gas that would ever hit the domestic market. We predict, and modelling from organisations has shown, that the gas from this project would be about four times what current gas users in WA pay for gas. And so this gas won't be available for Australian industry and consumers, and it won't be accessible because it's so expensive. This gas is to be exported to Japan in particular, but also Korea. And Japanese and Korean joint venture partners are also investors in this project. So we're also concerned that this continued expansion of gas into Asia, Australia is one of the largest exporters of gas, liquefied natural gas in the world. It's the largest into Asia. And by continuing to expand the gas industry into Asia, we're preventing those energy-hungry Asian economies from decarbonising and switching to renewables themselves. As people know, the climate science is now really clear. There can be no new gas and coal approvals if we're to stay within a safe climate. And so that's just another reason why this project can't go ahead. It's about the impacts here in Australia, but also the downside, the significant dangers for our climate in continuing to expand gas exports into our Asian trading partners.
And you mentioned a little bit the safeguard mechanism. Could you just sort of touch on what you meant by that, that it would take up all of, maybe just touch on what it is and, what
Yeah, I get asked a lot about the safeguard mechanism. So if people can steer with me for a second. So the safeguard mechanism is the federal government instrument to reduce emissions from the industry sector in Australia. So about 200 facilities, the highest industrial emitting facilities in Australia. So think like aluminium smelters or coal and gas projects, projects like that, about the 200 biggest of them. And the safeguard mechanism requires industrial emitters across Australia to reduce their emissions so that we can meet our climate targets. So those industrial emitters have to reduce their emissions by about 4.9% every year, and they've got some options about how they do that. So there is no point having something like the safeguard mechanism, which is designed to reduce industrial emissions in Australia so that we can meet our climate targets, if we're just going to approve new coal and gas projects which completely mitigate and wipe out any emissions reductions we get from something like the safeguard mechanism policy, if we're just going to approve coal and gas projects for export. It means that really, when it comes to Australia's emissions profile, we might be reducing our domestic emissions here in Australia, but we're just exporting those emissions by the coal and gas we export to other countries. And most of the emissions that Australia creates are for export. They are the emissions caused by when Australian coal and gas is burnt in Japan or Taiwan or Korea or China. That's where most of Australia's emissions are caused, actually, by our coal and gas exports.
And does the safeguard mechanism, does it account for exported coal and gas, or is it just...
No, it doesn't. But these big export projects, like this proposed Browse project by Woodside, they have significant emissions here in Australia. So even if the gas is exported, that gas has to be frozen to be turned into liquefied natural gas, into a liquid, so that it can be put on a boat and exported. The activity, I guess, or the industrial process to freeze that gas creates really significant emissions. So the biggest user of gas in Australia is actually the gas industry itself, freezing gas for export. So a lot of people think that, oh, if we're exporting coal and gas to other countries, they have to account for those emissions. But what people forget is that digging up coal and gas for export here in Australia still creates a lot of emissions here. So methane emissions from open cut coal mines in Australia through to, as I said, freezing gas for export are big causes of emissions here in Australia. So it's not just the emissions caused by burning that coal and gas overseas. We cause a lot of emissions just by extracting that coal and gas here in Australia, and that is accounted for under the safeguard mechanism if those emissions are high enough. Mm.
And so Woodside, they would if say the it went through, they would end up having to I guess offcut a lot of their safeguard mechanism. Is that kind of what would happen, or?
Yes, and we think those emissions are so high that they actually threaten the integrity of that safeguard mechanism. So we believe that, so Australia, people might remember, the Albanese government announced our 2035 emissions reduction target. So Australia has to reduce its emissions now by 62 to 70% by 2035. We don't think Australia can meet the upper end of that target if a project like Browse goes ahead. The emissions are so high that we won't be able to get emissions down in other sectors to accommodate the emissions from a project like Browse, if that makes sense. So we actually probably rule out achieving the more ambitious end of our 2035 emissions reduction targets. Those targets we desperately need to be met if we're to have any chance of having a safe climate here in Australia. That upper end target will not be met if this project goes ahead.
And just remind me again what listeners can do to prevent this happening.
Yeah, so there's a few things people can do. So the port to deliver that gas overseas is called the Northwest Shelf. ACF, the Australian Conservation Foundation, is taking the government to the federal court. We're going to have a rally tomorrow at the federal court, tomorrow from 8 o'clock, that people can join if they want to send a clear message to decision makers that the Northwest Shelf project should be reconsidered as a project to go ahead to export Browse gas. And if people want to help us stop that huge gas project, Browse, going ahead, Woodside's Browse project, please just visit the Australian Conservation Foundation's website or Greenpeace's website to find out more about what you can do.
Have you got much momentum with it so far in terms of support? Or?
Yeah, so for example, the submission process that we're inviting people to write submissions for this week, that submission date closes on Wednesday afternoon. We've already had over 65,000 submissions to that process, which has been fantastic. And that's because we know so many Australians are concerned about the need to have a safe climate and the need for the Albanese government to be a world leader when it comes to climate action. So we're really happy that so many Australians have already come out and taken the time, 65,000 of them and counting, writing a submission to say that they don't want this project to go ahead. So I urge people by Wednesday afternoon to jump on the ACF website and add your name to those submissions so the Albanese government knows that this is a project that's not wanted by most Australians. It's a time for coal and gas projects to be no longer ever approved in Australia for those projects to go ahead.
And is there anything else that the Australian Conservation Foundation has been up to?
Well, there's another big project that will also be running a very strong campaign on that some people might have heard of. That's an onshore huge fracking project in a place called the Beetaloo Basin that people might have heard of. This is Santos, not Woodside, but Santos are driving this project. And we'll have more to say on that soon. But that's another huge gas project, and fracking is strongly opposed by so many Australians and traditional owners up there on the Beetaloo as well. So we'll have more to say on that soon. On the domestic front, people would be seeing quite a bit of media around data centres, so artificial intelligence fueled data centres being constructed, planned and constructed across Australia. There's a lot of work to make sure that the energy supply for these data centres, they use enormous amounts of energy and also water, that if these projects go ahead, they need to be fuelled with renewable energy instead of driving further coal and gas expansion here in Australia. So we're keeping a close eye on that as well.
And so far, have they been mostly fueled by renewables, or because I think there's like 90 or something in Australia already?
There's so many proposed, and people might have seen on the weekend that the Albanese government started looking at guardrails for the construction of data centres. So we'll just need to make sure if those projects go ahead, they go ahead with social licence, they go ahead in places where people, where the community supports their construction, and that they're sustainable when it comes to their water use. And that they're building their own renewables because they're such energy-hungry projects. So we'll be watching those closely to make sure that if data centres are going ahead, they're building their renewable energy to power them.
Mm. Is there much regulation at the moment with that? Or because it seems like so many have been proposed in such a short amount of time.
I mean, there's the usual planning and approval processes that big projects like that need to go through, but we do think there need to be more specific guardrails around the rapid growth of the data center industry. So we'll be pushing for stronger regulation of that industry so that it builds in a sustainable way that's not encouraging unsustainable water use, as I said, or encouraging the further expansion of burning coal and gas here in Australia.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything listeners can do on that front?
Again, go to the Australian Conservation Foundation website to find out how you can get involved in any of these campaigns. Just get yourself on the ACF mailing list and we'll be in touch with you about these ways and other ways also that you can help Australia maintain a safe climate and show leadership on climate action.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Hopefully you'll be back in a month to update us again. But thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you to your 3CR listeners for their support in ACF campaigns for a safer world. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Gavin.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
I'm now joined on the line by Mary from Climate for Change. Mary, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me again.
And just to remind listeners, tell us a little bit about Climate for Change and the work it does.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a small nonprofit that focuses on helping people have better conversations about climate change and take action in their communities. So we have a lot of different resources and training available, to help people feel more confident having conversations, particularly with their family and friends and other people that they trust.
What are some of the key things you would say to someone wanting to improve the way they have conversations about climate change?
Sure, yeah. I mean, in our training sessions, we are really trying to undo, I guess, a lot of the training that people have had in the past about conversations, which is often like focused on debating or like persuasive writing, which are really fantastic skills, but are often not actually that conducive to having sort of an empathetic and productive conversation about something like climate change. Mm-hmm. So in our training, we really focus on helping people do things like build trust in their conversations and allow people to have autonomy to come to conclusions on their own rather than being forced into a particular conclusion, and also helping people connect with their values and see how their own values can connect to taking climate action. Mm. So some of the key skills that we talk to people about and help people practice are like how to ask really good questions in a conversation and how to listen deeply to people without judgment and also sharing your own climate story in a vulnerable way so that people can hear things that are relatable in that in your story and connect it to their own life as well.
Mm-hmm. So it's more about connecting first and then leading the conversation from there, as opposed to just presenting facts and trying to persuade. And how would you sort of suggest, to have conversations with someone who's supportive of climate action but maybe doesn't know what to do versus climate skeptics or deniers? Is there different tips for each kind of conversation?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, at Climate for Change, we really encourage people to focus on having conversations with people who are maybe believe in climate change but aren't doing something about it, who we would sort of put in that passive category, because they do make up the vast majority of the Australian population. Climate deniers and climate skeptics often have really loud voices, so we can overestimate their size or sort of how prominent they are in the community. But if we just focus on empowering people that believe that climate change is real but just, yeah, don't feel empowered or don't know what to do about it, we can really shift a really significant proportion of the population into taking action. Mm. I think that talking to people like that, it's all about figuring out where they're at and what sorts of actions and climate actions might fit into their daily life. I think a lot of the time people have, are aware of the idea of the personal carbon footprint, which is something that was created by British Petroleum, probably one of the most successful marketing campaigns in history, because it is so deeply ingrained in people that climate change is the responsibility of individuals to fix. I think that can be so overwhelming for a lot of people to feel like, yeah, that their personal actions are what's causing climate change.
And it's quite isolating. Quite isolating as well. And I think like that probably prohibits a lot of people from doing anything because they think, oh, I have to do so much individually and personally in my own life that like it's too much, it's too overwhelming, so I won't do anything else. But yeah, it's a hindrance.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I find a lot of the time that's sort of what is in a lot of people's way for taking action, because they think they've got that idea in their head that taking climate action means they have to stop eating meat and ride their bike everywhere and go completely plastic free, which are obviously all amazing things to do. But yeah, can be really overwhelming and isolating, but also don't tackle the more systemic problem that if we're burning fossil fuels, it doesn't matter how many people are doing those individual actions because the planet will keep warming if coal, oil and gas are still being used. So I think talking to people about how they can take action through our democracy is something that can be really empowering for people. I like to point out that as Australians, whether or not we're citizens and have voting rights, or you know, whether we're 18 yet, we have a huge amount of power to influence our government because we are really fortunate to live in a democracy. And as one of the very few countries that is a major fossil fuel exporter that is also a democracy, we have, as citizens or as people living in Australia, a unique power to shift our government. And it's something that people, you know, in countries like Russia or Saudi Arabia or even the United States just don't have the same access to. So as individuals, we can make a really big difference by doing things like writing to our MPs, by engaging in protests, by talking to our friends and family, particularly when there are elections coming up, and talking about the ways that our government can support Australians to live more sustainably and to have access to renewable energy that can bring down, you know, energy costs so much. I think that's, yeah, something that a lot of people find really empowering to find ways that they can influence those big systems.
Yeah, you said it's quite empowering. Are there sort of other empowering things that you would suggest maybe bringing up that make people feel this way? Because I do feel like people feel quite overwhelmed when talking about climate change because it is very doom and gloom. So, how do you have these kind of honest conversations that don't leave people feeling hopeless, that leave people feeling empowered? Are there, other things other than reminding us of our democracy?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big one is being in community and being connected to people that also really care and are taking action, because it reminds you then that it's not you versus the world. You're part of a huge network of people who also care and who are also doing lots of different things that are sort of shifting the way that we do things in this country and around the world. So trying to connect them with local groups, whether that's something like Climate for Change runs or with other community groups that are doing climate action. We've also got a lot of resources to sort of help people just do that with their own friends and family. We've got a Climate Action Clubs program that's kind of like a book club, but instead of meeting up every month to talk about a book, you meet up and do some climate actions together. Mm. So I think that, that sense of community is really important. Just finding things that fit in with people's lives so that it doesn't feel too overwhelming for them.
I think there's something to be said as well about, because it's quite often that as a climate activist, you try and sort of search for people who maybe have the same mindset and opinions as you, and it's important to connect with those people because you want to feel like you're not so isolated and alone. But I think also it's equally as important to connect with people who maybe aren't of that mindset. Mm-hmm. Not like the climate skeptics, but maybe like the passive kind of ones you said that maybe care, but don't really care that much. So what would you say for people who are maybe wanting to talk to their family members or people in their community that haven't necessarily been very open-minded or active on climate change? Yeah.
For sure. I think figuring out what those people value and trying to speak to those values is really important. If you've got someone who's really passionate about sport, maybe asking them some questions to see if they have seen the impact of extreme weather on their sport, or if they're someone who really values protecting their family or really values fairness, maybe talking about how you feel like it's unfair that fossil fuel companies make so much money while everyday people have to deal with the costs of increasing climate disasters. I think figuring out what those values are and speaking to those is a really critical thing to do. If you've got the people who are passive, you're pretty confident that they do care about climate change. They just haven't had the right moment. Just inviting them to come to something with you. And even if they aren't able to come or they don't want to come, that can be sort of the start of a conversation where you can maybe help unpack with them the reasons why they might feel anxious about going, or they might feel like they don't fit into that particular that action or that event. That can be the start of supporting them to take more action as well. Mm-hmm. We talk about all of this stuff and sort of help people make plans for engaging with their communities in our 2-hour training sessions. Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in coming along, then they can check out all the dates that we've got on our website as well.
Mm-hmm. And I read a report, and I can't remember what it was by, but they were talking about how more effective conversation happens when the person who's maybe trying to do the persuading or the welcoming is sort of accepting of the fact that they might equally be as changed from the conversation as like what the other person would be. So I think that's a good mindset to like sort of bring into these conversations as well, is like understanding that you're not kind of going in there to educate and to sort of present facts and persuade, like you said, but you're going in there to potentially learn as much about someone else and where they come from, and maybe your own mind will be kind of transformed in a way by that interaction. So I think that's probably, yeah important as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Going in with curiosity is so important.
I wanted to ask a little bit about social media, because I think the kind of social media landscape, it seems as though while it's been like super helpful in connecting us to people that we might not have normally been connected to, it's also this very like polarizing and very charged environment and way of communicating with people. Is there sort of any tips you have for like, I guess, transgressing these boundaries with social media, and in terms of how it's, well, firstly, like, how do you think it's been a help or a hindrance in having these kind of meaningful conversations? And then also, if you have any advice on how you might connect through these online platforms and not just in person? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that, putting social media into a category of like good or bad is just not possible. It's been definitely both in terms of climate messaging. And it's amazing when, you know, we sometimes get brand new people coming to our programs and getting involved in climate action because they've seen something on social media. But equally, I think social media is such a platform, particularly for climate denial and climate skepticism, that paints a picture that is just not accurate of the way that most Australians feel. Mm-hmm. I think that wherever possible, it's really good to try and get these conversations offline, or at least into more private and long form discussions. So I think so many of the problems come from people having conversations in comment sections that are sometimes really brief, but also are quite performative, because people, like, obviously anyone can see it, or lots of people can see it. And I just don't think that's particularly conducive to a conversation where you can build openness and trust. So I think, if you're trying to have a good conversation with somebody, it's really great to try and do that with them over the phone or in person, or at least moving it into, a more private space where people can feel safe to be honest and to be genuinely curious with each other. But I think that social media can be a great way to get conversations started, particularly between friends. Doing things like sharing, hey, I'm going to this climate action event in a couple of weeks, like, does anyone want to come with me? Or even just signalling to your friends and family that climate is something that you're passionate and that you care about, so that people kind of feel confident to approach you if they're curious or if they have questions. Mm-hmm. I think can be really powerful in that way too.
Yeah. And for listeners who perhaps wanted to have a better climate conversation this week, have you got sort of just maybe one piece of advice you want people to take away from today? Sort of, what's the first thing a listener should do to engage in a meaningful climate conversation?
Yeah, I think go in and ask as many questions as you can, and then truly listen to the answers. And mainly just have a go. Like, I think a lot of people feel really nervous to have climate conversations because they're worried that maybe they don't know enough about the science, or they're worried that they're not going to be able to answer every question perfectly. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that you need to have a good conversation about climate change is to care about the climate and about the person that you're talking to as well. Mm-hmm. So, I think if you go in with that with a genuine sense of care and curiosity, I think that's a great starting point.
Mm-hmm. And sort of to move the conversation just in a different direction, I saw that you have an event coming up about fossil fuel sponsorship of children's education activities. Can you just tell us a little bit about that? Because that's really interesting,
For sure, yeah. So Yeah, we've got an event on the 30th of July. It's one of our online climate action clubs, which is basically just we get together once a month for an hour and a half. We talk about a particular climate issue, and then we do a climate action related to that issue. And this month we're focusing on the new report that was developed by Comms Declare, which is called From Cradle to Career. And it's a research report about the ways that coal, oil and gas companies have sponsored various programs related to Australian children, from education through to, like, the nippers. Mm. And it is I found the report pretty confronting.
It's a terrifying,
the ways in which, fossil fuel companies have, are so entrenched and are marketing to children to try and make sure that they maintain their social license. Mm. I think the story that really stuck out to me was a sponsored lesson plan that had children calculate the carbon footprint of their parents driving them to school and had no mention of the fact that coal, oil and gas are causing the climate crisis.
Yeah.
And that just made me so upset to think about kids feeling like it's their fault that climate change is happening because they're being driven to school.
That's a tactic that's been happening for so long, but, I mean, this is, like, the first time I've heard of a report being done about how deep
Absolutely.
It goes. Yeah.
Yeah, so Comms Declare and Parents for Climate and Teachers for Climate are calling for a Senate inquiry to be done because there's still a lot of lack of transparency around, the influence of fossil fuel sponsorship on children.
Mm-hmm.
So in the session next week, we'll talk more about the report and then we're going to be writing to our senators to call for a Senate inquiry.
Mm. Is there any other way listeners can maybe get behind in supporting that?
Yeah. If you can have a look at Comms Declare and their website. They're an amazing organisation. And you can read the report in full.
Mm-hmm.
We've also got a sort of briefing and email template on our website that we will use in the session next week, but people can also use in their own time. So if you'd like a template to contact your senators or MPs, you can find that on our website too.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Mary.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show. Today's show featured an update from Gavin, the Climate and Energy Program Manager at the Australian Conservation Foundation, who gave an update on current campaigns and what's been going on with the ACF this past month, particularly Woodside Energy's Browse gas development off the coast of WA. If you want to stay up to date with the Australian Conservation Foundation, go to acf.org.au. We also spoke to Mary from Climate for Change. She shared some tips on how to have effective conversations about climate change. You can find out more about Climate for Change, the work they do, and their upcoming events at climateforchange.org.au. If you want to listen back to the show, go to 3cr.org.au/climateaction, and we'll be back next Monday at 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.